Accession number 18757. Real one.
Okay, could we start by you telling me when you were born?
Yes, I was born on the 18th of April, 1924.
Mm-hmm. And what was your background? What did your father do? Where did you live?
He was a butcher. I lived in Weston Supermare.
Oh yeah.
And he had his own little butcher shop in the Milton area. Mostly, his work was done, strangely enough, through a mobile butchery in a van where he chopped and cut meat in the streets of Weston.
Yes. And did he do his own butchery? I mean, did he...
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
The animals fresh?
Yes. That's,
you don't find that happening very much these days, do you?
No, I didn't like it at the time when I was a boy.
It was on the premises, was it?
I was, yeah.
Yeah.
It was rather nasty. I don't know. See the sheep looking up at you, you know, when you strapped them to a block. You know.
Yeah, yeah.
Wasn't nice. And then my first introduction to the slaughterhouse was horrifying. I was there for a morning, and I was all right while I was there. I didn't enjoy it, but in the afternoon I was violently sick. So that was the last I had to do with the butchery trade. I didn't want to know it.
What was your first job then?
First job was with more or less my only job, was with a very nice man who made Western Rock with the letters running through it, Western Rock. And I'd have stayed with him but for the war. He was rationed with sugar and none at all. So we were all sacked, more or less. He went into the special constables, and I went and worked in a timekeeper's office when they were building a shadow factory locally. And from there I joined the RAF.
What year would that be when you joined?
43. Uh-huh. Joined the VR early 43 and was called up July 43, yes.
And did you volunteer for aircrew straight away or...?
No, I tried to get in the Navy. And
what they're in. Yeah. So even though you joined the RAF VR, you still wanted to go in the Navy, did you?
Yes, I didn't quite remember how that worked out. I think I joined the RAF VR. Must have been after the Navy interview.
Uh-huh.
Because I went for an interview in... I was going to be called up, basically. So I went to... I had to report to the Labour Exchange, I think, in Bristol. And I went to the seen the naval officer, filled in forms. And he said, come with me. And he took me upstairs to an RAF officer. And I think he suggested I should join the Air Training Corps. And I became a volunteer reserve.
Why was the Navy full up then? Why didn't they want you?
I think that day they wanted air crew.
Oh, is that it? Yeah.
For the 1,000 bomber raids and what have you that they were losing so many on.
Yeah.
At the time. So from there I joined the RAF and let things just roll. Never pushed or... I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the sporting facilities. Very much indeed. And fitness, terrifically fit.
Were you based around here, or did
I? No, I was, the nearest I got here was Netheravon.
Mm.
And it was from Netheravon I went on to the Berlin Airlift. And that, strangely enough, was on sports day. I was all geared up to win some nice prizes on sports day. And we were all sent to Germany.
Anyhow, if I can just sort of come back a bit before then. you were chosen for air crew and you trained as a signaller, did you?
Or, that's right, yes.
Or wireless operator, I think.
Wireless operator. And
yeah.
They were normally, it was wireless operator air gunners, but we were trained as wireless operators only, not as air gunners. Done a course of Madly about 12 months. And
from
Madly, near Hereford.
Oh, yeah.
And from Madly to operational training unit on Wellington's at a place called Wing. That was near Aylesbury, I think. And from there on to Lancaster's, where we crewed up with a flying officer, Hodson. And when we finished the course on Lancaster's, we were kept back to go to the Far East, just our crew only, Doncaster, to go with a squadron to the Far East. It never materialized. And they sent me to, sent the whole crew on leave except me. They sent me to Ringway, parachute course. Done the parachute course, went on leave, and rejoined the crew at a place called Oldby, Leicester East. And when I arrived, of course, it was only the Flying Officer Hodson, Alan, the second pilot, and the navigator. And we converted to Dakotas there, which was
So you never did join Bomber Command then?
No, Training Command and Transport Command.
Mm.
It was
what squadron of Dakotas was that? Do you remember?
271.
Mm.
The one that Lord won his VC on, same squadron.
Mm.
And
you weren't on the Arnhem landings then?
No, missed that by few months, I think.
Mm.
They were. I go to their reunions actually. There's one next month because a lot of the chaffers that were at Arnhem were still on the squadron when I joined it. Mm. You know, they were.
What, you went out to the Far East on your, with your Dakota squadron, did you?
Oh, well,
no, the squadron was based at Manston. We.
Oh. Just going back, why were you chosen to be for a parachute course?
Because the radio operator on Dakotas was the dispatcher.
Mm.
He had to play the part of the dispatcher for paratroops. And they didn't like the idea, or the RAF believed, that it wouldn't be right for a man to dispatch paratroopers who'd never done a parachute jump himself. So we were all radio operators on Dakotas, done the parachute course. And I was unfortunate in his match that when we were at Upper Hayford, radio ops had to take this course. So I explained to the CO, I'd already done it, but he said, well, you're going to do it again. So I'd done two parachute jumps, and of course they were both from balloons, which was only about 700 feet high, and your chute opened at about, you had quite a long drop, 100 feet or more, before your chute opened, because there was no slipstream to take it away. Where were we?
About parachute training and why you had to do it. That's really what I asked. Anyhow, if I can, you were with 271 Squadron and you went to Manscombe.
That's right. And we operated there mostly to India and a few continental trips. But the India trip was scheduled five and a half days. Invariably it took us 9 days. Sometimes the wonderful thing about it was we'd be sleeping in a leaking Nissen hut at one airfield and stopping in a first class hotel at another one. So we led quite a...
When would this be? About 1945?
Would be, yeah.
What was the routing you took to India? Can you remember it?
Yes, vaguely, yes. Manston to Elmas, which was on the southern tip of Sardinia. That was a 7-hour leg, but we could do it with a good tailwind in 4.5-5 hours. Elmas to Cairo West to Habaniya in Iraq. Habaniya to Shaiba to Karachi. And coming back, they always seemed to send us on what they called the bad weather route, which took us much further south, Aden,
Khartoum.
No, not Khartoum, I don't think. No, Aden. Now, where do we go from Aden?
Cairo again?
No.
Anyhow,
we finished up coming back through Malta and sometimes Jib. Come along the north coast of El Adam in North Africa. But before then, I'm trying to think of the...
Would you come up
a place called Purim Island.
Uh-huh.
Horrible.
Was that
place
in the Red Sea?
Yes.
Yeah.
With the airfield practically covered the island. And the only amusement for the chap stationed there was shark fishing. And first time we were severely reprimanded for not bringing any green vegetables to them. So we put club together and bought vegetables to take to Purim Island on the next trip. And we never went in there. We got rid of them all right.
Now, you were carrying mainly personnel, I suppose.
Yes, troops.
Yeah.
First one was a freight, and then we were made a grade 2 or grade 1 passenger car. Grade 2 passenger car, and that's right. And we started taking troops then. And then after the India trips, we were actually taking civilians on the continent, mostly for the Nuremberg trials.
What, legal people?
Yeah.
So this was virtually the end of the war you were flying out, the end of
We were, the European war was practically over before, when we were, when we converted to the closers, it was practically over. Oh, I remember, because on our last trip on Lancaster's, we were dropping window over France, so this, and we went as far as where the front line was, and dropping window, that's not reflective. And then we were recalled, and we scooted back to base as fast as we could, and the main bomber streams went in on a different route.
So you were with the Lancaster Operational Squadron for a
day? No, this was our last training trip.
What, on ITU?
On... in training command, we weren't. We may have been attached to them for the trip. I don't know technically behind the scenes, but we were never never on bomber command as such.
Now your equipment presumably was the standard RAF radio equipment.
No, we had American.
Oh, you did. You didn't have the 1154.
No, we trained on the 1154 and 1155. And then we had to retrain on the American one, Liaison SCR, a marvellous set.
They always are, aren't they? We always have rubbish for our own forces. The American stuff is way ahead, isn't it?
But the tuning units, you see, you had so much of it. I mean, today they wouldn't entertain the weight of it in a Dakota. But the tuning units was that length. And they were stacked.
Well, about 2 feet by one,
up to the ceiling. And you changed your tuning unit for the different frequencies. Whereas with the Marconi, you could do the whole lot by adjusting the knobs.
And you communicated mainly with Morse key, did you?
Always, yeah. VHF was just coming in then, and we were equipped with it on the Dakota. The range was visual. If you couldn't see the transmitting station, that is to say, if it wasn't within visual range, you couldn't reach it. But it improved all the time, VHF, you know, and you could go anywhere practically on VHF alone, really.
But otherwise, you have an aerial for shortwave on the aircraft, did you?
And a trailing aerial.
And a trailing aerial for what, for longer waves?
Medium range, medium, the lower frequency is very good for direction finding and I think it was mostly... There was a chain of stations all being built all through Europe, and three of these stations would tune into a signal from you and take bearings, and this would be plotted, and you could obtain a rough fix.
Now, between the end of the war and when you were called in for the Berlin airlift in 1948, were you mainly on communication duties in Europe? Or where, you know, what flying did you do with your Dakotas?
Trooping from India.
Far East all the time. Yeah.
And the continent. And the, coming back, here you are, prodding my memory. Yeah. we were doing passenger services to Rome. Naples. Rome was a regular. It was a lovely trip. We'd go out one day, stop a day, come back the following day. So we used to have a day in Rome once At least once a week, sometimes twice a week.
Were this VIP passengers or?
Pardon?
Were they VIP trips or just ordinary?
They were passengers, but who they were, I don't know.
They were RAF related.
We brought back a lot of wives, Italian wives, from Rome, yes. Naples. And we used to go down to Sicily. Yeah, there was... that was quite good. I used to... well, we all knew our way around Rome. Probably a lot better than I do Bristol or London.
Presumably you brought lots of goodies back, did you?
Silk stockings was the in thing at the time. This is my second wife, my first wife. Used to be about the only one in Western wearing... what did they call them? Fully fashioned stockings with seam down the back.
So this was the pattern of your flying then until the Berlin Airlift started?
Well, until, yes, I got posted to Netheravon and we're dropping parachutists. On, I think it was Western Green.
Was this the Salisbury plane?
Mm. Yeah. Just take off, drop the parachutes, back again. reload, take them off, drop them all day long. It was monotonous.
Yeah.
And when the airlift came, it was very pleasing. So,
what are your memories of the start of the airlift? You know, were you you were on your sports day, weren't you? Or something?
That's right. We were on the sports day at Netheravon, and we got back to the billet. This was the day before the sports day. The sports day was on the Thursday. This was on the Wednesday. And somebody put swastikas on our cabin doors. So we found out the following morning what it was all about. And we went to Wunsdorf. Oh, no, Fassburg.
Fassburg, yeah.
Fassburg, I think, was the first station. And during the airlift, of course, we moved from Fassburg to Wunsdorf and to Lübeck. So we flew from all three places to Berlin.
When you were ordered over to Fassburg, did you know what it was all about, or you were just ordered to go there?
Oh, we knew, we had a rough idea. We knew basically that the corridor had been sealed off and that we were going to fly food into Berlin, yes.
And what was Fassburg like when you arrived?
Chaos, eh? It was chaos. We were scheduled. Now, you may have heard this before, but we were scheduled for four trips a day. But the day was only 20 hours long. If you started your day shift or night shift, it might be, the idea was to for all crews to have a fair share of day and night flying, so they had a 20-hour day. So if I was on duty tonight, I'd probably only do three trips, rarely done four, but three mostly. If I was due on at midday today, tomorrow my shift would start at 8 o'clock in the morning. The following day, it would start at 4 o'clock in the morning. Then, the day after, it would be midnight that night when you started. It was always 4 hours early. So you'd done a 20-hour day and an 8.5-hour, 8.5-day week, in effect. You'd done 8 days work in a in a week rather than 7, because there was no time off. When you had time off, the aircraft was due for service. You bring it back to England, a few days off while it was being serviced, then go back out again. So there was no time or wasted manpower at all.
Now, those early trips, what were you carrying? What was your cargo?
Coal.
Coal, was it? In sacks?
In sacks, yeah. And it was filthy. The aircraft got filthy. They always got cleaned out when we came back. But they kept special aircraft for passengers. When we started carrying food, and we had clean aircraft, and we started bringing passengers out, German families, mostly women and children, out of Berlin on the return trip. So we always had clean aircraft then.
Can you remember what the passengers were like? I mean, did you, or was it the loadmaster who had most to do with the passengers in the aircraft?
Yeah, we didn't have a lot to do with them. It was we seen them, obviously, but we never went back to chat with them or anything like that. Because we were getting hardened then in the early days when we were bringing casualties back from Belgium. The skipper said to me, Ernie, go and have a chat with the casualties, you know, boost their morale and what have you. And which I did, I went back, only to discover, having chatted with all of them, because they were stretcher cases, one at a time, that there wasn't one hurt in the war.
Really?
They were all their injuries were brought about by football, falling off streetcars, or something like that. Not one.
They didn't need the morale boosting then?
No, they didn't need anything. They were down on a good sky, actually, and we were flying them back to England. And that's going back a bit again now. Things come back to mind when you are talking about one thing.
Can you tell me of a typical trip? Because I've talked to air traffic control people and so on, where they've brought in streams of aircraft.
Mm.
Now, presumably, you all took off in rapid succession, did you?
Yes.
Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yes. The weather for the summer in Germany was pretty... It was like this.
Mm. Very wet.
It was a horrible summer. And we quite often... We took off about 1 minute intervals. And we would always try and get last a taxi out. Find some thing to do on the Dakota and be last to taxi out. This meant that we would be last to go, last to come back, and we'd only do 3 trips instead of 4 trips in our shift, you see. So we'd go out, taxi out in this weather, and take off in it, as I say, about 1 minute intervals. And when you broke cloud, we say it might be 3,000, 4,000 feet, and you've seen the Dakotas within touching distance almost, you wondered just how close you got to them in the cloud. I mean, sometimes you break cloud and you wouldn't see one. Some obviously were faster than others, and some were a bit slower, and some pilots steered a better course, but you could break cloud and you could almost put your wingtip in the doorway of the adjoining Dakota.